Hallito and welcome to Native Chalk Talk, a podcast by Natives for all. Here we're keeping our Native ancestors' stories and history alive, while also sharing with you our Native culture, traditions, and more. I'm Rachel Youngman, a Choctaw originally from Anadarko, Oklahoma. I hope you'll enjoy this journey with me as we learn from our Native American guests. And I hope you'll do me a favor. Feel free to like and share these episodes. I so appreciate it. Yakuki.
Y'all, I have to show you my new favorite soap from Baker's Bar Soapery. Check out this Yunish, which means buffalo in Choctaw. It's scented with leather fragrance, so I bought one for my husband and one for me too, of course, and it smells so good. This soap is a tribute to the Choctaw and the resilience of the buffalo. Luxury soaps, lotions, and lip balms from Baker's Bar Soapery are 100% Choctaw crafted. And yes, these are made with goat's milk, so they leave your skin feeling soft and supple. So load up on these Choctaw soaps made by Tiffany at Baker's Bar Soapery at thebbsoapery.com. But be sure to get 20% off when you use the code NATIVECHOCKTALK, that's all caps, when you spend $25 or more. Treat yourself to the luxury your skin deserves with Baker's Bar Soapery.
It was the wild, wild west, a time after the Civil War in which cattle rustlers, horse thieves, and lawlessness reigned supreme. It was up to many individuals to take the law into their own hands in order for some semblance of order to emerge. Vigilantes and light horsemen like the ancestors of my Choctaw guest had their work cut out for them as they bravely attempted to tame Indian territory. Listeners, welcome Bobby Bulls. Hallito, Bobby, and welcome to Native Choctaw.
Hallito, Rachel. It's good to visit with you.
I'm really excited about today's show. We're going to cover a lot about that lawlessness and the wild, wild west. But let's start talking about your mother. What was her name?
Her name was Charlene Benton, was her maiden name, and just a, in my opinion, a wonderful woman. Had a tremendous sense of humor, loved her heritage, and was very artistic, and just a pleasure to be around.
Oh, and she was absolutely beautiful. So for
Thank
those
you.
Of you who are listening and not watching us on video on YouTube, I'll be sure to post photos of Bobby's beautiful mother and his family as well on my Native Choctaw Facebook page. I noticed she was born in Bokchido in Oklahoma. Did you ever visit there?
I did. Not very often, but we did get back periodically. Of course, we lived in Texas, but we would get back to Durant, Bokchida, and that area periodically. We still had relatives that lived in that area.
Okay, so. Yeah. That's good, because a lot of times I think when we're doing our research and honoring our ancestors, it's really hard to picture some of the things that went on unless we can go visit their homelands.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you for sharing about your beautiful mother, Charlene.
Thank you.
Yeah. So now we'll follow Charlene's Choctaw lineage and the amazing stories of the Benton and Turnbull families. Your grandpa, Charles Wesley Benton, was your mother's father. And growing up, did you know him? What was he like?
I did. And he was a very loving grandfather. Of course, I was the oldest grandchild and grandson, and just enjoyed being around him. And he was very proud of his heritage as well. Following again along the sense of humor and the personality, he was a character. And he and my mother both loved a good practical joke, and we love to laugh and tease each other and play jokes on other people, unsuspecting, of course.
Oh, so April Fool's Day was a big day for y'all, huh?
Absolutely, absolutely.
I think a lot of people don't realize that what they like to call Indian humor is a real thing, and there's a lot of facetiousness that goes on that you may not even catch until later when you're thinking about it. Henri. So we've talked about Charlene and her father, Charles, and then Charles's dad was Theodore Benton. So that's your great grandpa, correct?
That is correct. Yes.
Okay. And for our listeners, he was born in 1880 and he had a fun nickname. Tell us about that.
His nickname was Toad or Toady. And the best we can tell, or the story goes, is he got the name because of either children or grandchildren or other people not quite able to say Theodore. And it sounded like they called him Toad or Toady. So the nickname stuck, and he lived with that for the rest of his life. So he was known as Toad.
And that's so funny. I was curious where that came from. So did you get to meet him as well?
I did. When I met him and got to know him, he was at that time living in Plainview, Texas, okay. which was only about 75 miles from where I lived in Amarillo. And I got to spend a lot of time with my grandfather, Charles, and in his home. And Toad would come to visit periodically, or we would go to Plainview and visit with him. So he passed away when I was probably in the neighborhood of 12 years old. But as a child growing up, the time that I did get to spend around him, he was just a figure that I couldn't, decide. I couldn't make it out exactly. We looked completely different, being a blonde-headed Choctaw, and Toad was a full-blooded Choctaw Indian. But he was very quiet around me, but very, very laid back, let me ask him questions, talk to him, and things like that. So I was very fortunate to get to know him and his wife, my great-grandmother.
Yes. Yeah, because so many people don't know their great-grandparents. A lot of times they're already passed away. So that's so special that you got to have that.
It is. And that was my first indication in life that I might be a little bit different, mixed blood of Choctaw heritage. I always knew that he was an Indian. And of course, his appearance was quite prominent. So
he was born in 1880, died in 1967. Is that correct? Because that's amazing.
That is correct.
Correct. I mean, so the things that they saw in that time frame is incredible.
Oh, it is. And as we get into a little more history and detail, the things that they went through, you could hear stories from them going back to riding horseback, baggage, or buggy and carriage and things like that, as a mode of transportation, and the hard work and the lack of comforts that we have now is just amazing. And of course the use of the Choctaw language was taught to them as infants and children.
Yeah. Yeah.
When they were sent to the academies, they were given names of white people, and of course they seemed to fare better that way, having white names, things like that. So they, whether they wanted to do it or not, maybe abandoned some of the things that showed that they were native. So
yeah, which is so sad that they ever had to feel that way. But now we're honoring them as the only way we know how, by sharing their stories.
That's true.
Your great-grandpa Toad, he married a gal named, is it Oni Fitzer?
Yes, her nickname Oni. Was her name was Iona, and her nickname was Oni, and she was a German woman. She passed away before Toad, preceded him in death by about 6 years. But I did get to know her, and the two of them together were all about family. They love their family. They love their children, great-grandchildren. And of course, being the oldest, I probably knew them a little better than the others. So I'm sure that they liked me better. So,
of course they did.
So, and as
of course
I'm,
they
I'm
did.
Hoping my siblings will watch this. So I was always a favorite of my mother, grandfather, and great grandfather. Every visit that I made to their house, you know, they were very happy to see us. Loved to cook, play cards, games. Loved to have, they would have 50 people in their house, little two-bedroom house.
Love that.
Children, grandchildren, and things like that. So they were very, very family-oriented.
They got married in 1906, which was the same year that Toad had enrolled on the Dawes Rolls. And then according to Ancestry.com, Theodore was a farmer, and he and Oney lived with his mother, Mary, the first year, helping her and saving to start their own home. And there's a reason they moved in to help her. For our listeners, we'll talk about that in just a moment. But their first child was born July 11th, 1907. And in the fall, they moved to their own home, a 1-inch by 12-inch plankboard, 3-room house on the same plot of land allotted him by the U.S. government. Things had grown a little better for them by the time their fifth child was born, fifth child, and the family had outgrown the old house. I wonder why. So a 5-room house ready cut for assembling was ordered from Sears and Roebuck, and they had 8 children. And they reared the family on their land in Bryan County, Indian Territory. In 1926, pastures looked greener over the fence, so Toad and Oney moved the family in a Model T truck to West Texas, around and near Plainview. I can just picture them putting everything in the Model T and heading down to Texas.
it just something out of a movie. I can just,
yes,
you know, but.
Moving a little bit further back, your great-great-grandfather was Charles Henry Benton. Now, I say his last name was Benton, but that was not originally his family name. What was his family name?
Well, his father's name was Wakatombi.
Okay.
That was the only name we were given, and his mother, Shaka Foma, both walked the Trail of Tears. They were born in the early 1800s, and it appears as though they moved to Oklahoma Territory in the last migration in the mid 1850s. But he, I believe it was Jones Academy. I'm not sure which one of the academies he enrolled in originally, and was given the name Benton. And that's how that name started in our family. So,
and Wakatombi to Benton. No diss on the Benton name, but I mean, it's Wakatombi is such a cool name. And what does it mean?
Well, in my understanding, it's translated as cattle trader in Choctaw.
Really? How cool.
And once they migrated to Oklahoma, strangely or interestingly, he raised livestock and did quite well.
Okay.
Trading livestock. The academies, once the children started to school, got white names. I believe one of the teachers or somebody in one of the schools saw a name on a shirt that said Benton. And from my understanding, that's just picking the name, said, okay, Charles, your name will now, you're going to go by Benton. Your name is now Benton.
So Wakatombi marries Shaka Foma in 1825. And what does her name mean?
Her name roughly translates from family lore is bird of news, or bird who brings news. So, which kind of leads me to believe maybe she was quite the gossip. So, I'm not
That's
sure.
That's awesome.
But I'm just going to give her the benefit of the doubt that that she was probably somebody who got around quite often. So
that's fabulous. Well, and they are, you know, were, like you said, in that pivotal moment of the removal and coming over on what's now called the Trail of Tears. Charles was born in 1847. So he was pretty young when he came over. And for any child to survive that is pretty impressive. So
Yes, I believe there were two brothers, Charles and Robert, that were in the migration, and they and some other children, and they were the only two that survived.
Okay, so we have Wakatombi, who marries Shakafoma, and they have a son named Charles. Well, from rootsweb.com, about 1877, Mary Turnbull is a gal that meets and marries Charles Henry Benton. So it is believed that the family came from Louisiana to Indian Territory toward the end of the migration in 1853. It's thought that Charles was from the Sugarloaf District. And in 1884, Charles was the first judge, actually, at Hotchubby near Poto. And then Charles's gravestone stands alone in a pasture close to the ruins of an old house that may have been his home place. So again, Charles marries into the Turnbull family. So let's talk about his wife, Mary Turnbull. What do you know about her?
Well, Mary was the daughter of Turner Turnbull Sr. And his middle name was Brashears, Turner Brashears Turnbull Sr.
Okay, right.
So Mary was his daughter, married Charles Henry Benton. So that's the first indication that the Bentons and the Turnbulls
getting
together. So,
the below is a combination of information that I took from the History of Bryan County, Oklahoma by Heritage Association, Inc., written by Irene Benton Coe, which I believe was a great-granddaughter, as well as rootsweb.com. So one researcher has described Mary as one of the Turnbull women who were the real strength of many early families. Mount Pleasant, where Mary grew up, was about 9 miles east of present-day Caddo. It was and still is perhaps the most beautiful site in two counties, Bryan and Atoka. The only true flat ground for miles around, it overlooks the rich valley of the Boggy River, and away in the distance, the pine-covered, deceptively appearing soft peaks of the Kaimichi to the south, the rolling grass-covered prairies at the foot of Sugarloaf Mountain, to the west and north, the rugged hills and primitive forest. Directly below this bluff, a very old rock wagon road is visible that must have serviced the communities for many years. Many Indians made their homes nearby, Turnbull, Folsom, Ward, and many others. On this site, they built a church, a school, a home for mission teachers and boarding students, a store nearby, and an enclosure for the horse of the post. Sunday schools were well established at the Mount Pleasant Mission for all Indians to better their reading, writing, and arithmetic skills. It would stand to reason all the Turnbull children were well educated. Some went on to higher education after the mission school, and Mary was born at Mount Pleasant in 1856, Blue County, now Bryan County, Indian Territory. About the 10th of the children born to the prominent Choctaw family, Dr. Turner Brashears Turnbull Sr., and Angelico Jericho Perkins, as you mentioned earlier. There is a Turnbull child named Nancy Turnbull listed in the Mount Pleasant Presbyterian Indian Mission records, whose birth date is the same as Mary's, and Mary's name is not there. So possibly it was a twin who did not live past infancy or something like that. And according to the family, there were three sets of twins. Do you know anything else about that? Sounds like there were a lot of twins in the family, huh?
No, I don't know anything about that. I'm glad I missed that. I don't need any twins in my family, may I not have any twins, but they did have two twins, Charles and Clem. They were both killed by rustlers and at some point, and from the family lore that I've heard passed down, They were actually killed with bows and arrows to make it look like they were murdered by Indians rather than white rustlers. How much of that is actually true, I'm not sure, but that is part of the family history. So
interesting. Yeah, when I read that part, I was just blown away. It says Mary Turnbull married Charles Benton in Indian Territory. They had 6 sons and 2 daughters. Several of those children died. 2 of those children who passed away at 15-year-olds were twins Clem and Charles. One of the most striking facts to catch even a casual observer at the Turnbull family cemetery east of Caddo on the Stewart Ranch is the double headstone bearing Clement and Charles Benton's names. It would stand to reason they died some sort of violent death, and they did. It was a few days before their 18th birthday, and they were attending Preston City School when both were shot at the same time by cattle rustlers. Clemen was the first to die March 27th, 1902, and Charles 15 days later at their Uncle Turner's home. Quoting from the obituaries in the Caddo Herald, they were grand and noble youths, always full of sunshine and happiness. Life was hard then, and a few Indian men lived to be old. I mean, it truly was the wild, wild west, wasn't it, Bobby?
Oh, it was. It really was. You know, dangers lurked around every corner. And
yes.
You know, after the Civil War, it was just lawless territory.
Let's talk about cattle rustling and cattle drives. According to Texas Trails Pathways of History, cattle theft originally by Native Americans was a common hazard. Though they more often stole horses when their food supply was short, they drove off and butchered beeves, dairy cows, and oxen. In the Civil War and Reconstruction periods, Mexican rustlers gave much trouble along the border, where it was asserted that from 1859 through 1872, Mexican bandits stole 145,298 cattle from various South Texas ranches. However, this was exceeded by white cattle rustlers, where they would cross the Rio Grande by night and trail the stolen cattle to Kansas markets. Other rustlers stampeded herds on the northward trails and drove off as many cattle as they could, using six-shooters to defend themselves if pursued. The altering of brands was a frequent practice among rustlers. Instead of the stamp iron used by most cattlemen, the rustler used a running iron, a straight rod with a curve at the heated end. When this was outlawed, he sometimes used a piece of heavy wire that he could bend into any shape and carry in his pocket. More common was the theft of large unbranded calves. When a ranchman neglected to brand some of his calves before they were weaned, it was easy for the rustler to cut a pasture fence, drive the calves to his corral, and stamp his own brand on them. Often he would return to take also the smaller calves not yet weaned. This was more ticklish procedure since longhorn cows and calves had a strong instinct for returning to each other even when separated by miles. Aw. Such reunions had to be prevented, for if a ranchman found a calf with a rustler's brand nursing from one of his cows, there likely would be trouble. Before branding unweaned calves, often the rustler kept them penned until they quit bawling and learned to eat grass. Other measures used to keep them from getting back to their mothers and to hasten weaning were to cut the muscles supporting the calf's eyelids and thus make it temporarily blind, to apply a hot iron between the toes to make the calf's feet too sore for walking, or in uncommon cases, to split the calf's tongue to prevent suckling. The rustler might also kill the mother to make one calf a genuine orphan. Oh my gosh, Bobby, this is terrible. I never knew this. So bad. I should have probably warned our listeners. So it sounds like, you know, the cattle rustling, obviously stealing cattle is obviously against the law, but then on top of it, there was cruelty. With county seats far apart, grand juries disinclined to indict, and trial juries reluctant to convict, early cattlemen often had to take law enforcement into their own hands in dealing with rustlers. According to Andrew Fisher of William & Mary College, the Bill of Rights Institute.org states, the heyday of open range ranching and long trail drives lasted only about 20 years, and the cowboys of this period were generally wage workers rather than independent cattlemen. Spanish settlers first introduced both cattle and horse-mounted vaqueros to the Southwest during the 17th century. After the Civil War, competing railways established depots in Kansas to attract the business of cattle ranchers who had previously taken their stock to Louisiana or Missouri. Lengthy cattle drives were feasible because semi-wild longhorns endured them well and fetched high prices at the stockyard, despite their lean, tough meat. Steers bought for $10 a head or less in Texas could be sold for $25 or more at a railhead in Kansas. The cattle towns, in turn, could make money selling supplies, alcohol, and sexual companionship to the cowboys who congregated there at the end of the drive. Herding cattle on these trails entailed a lot of drudgery, discomfort, occasional danger, and huge amounts of dust. On a typical drive, a crew of only 10 to 15 drovers would be responsible for moving approximately 2,000 steers and 100 to 150 horses across hundreds of miles of open prairie in all kinds of weather. For their trouble, they received $40 a month and a steady diet of beans, biscuits, hard cheese, and coffee from the chuck wagon. Stampedes, Indians, and rustlers created the occasional thrill, but gunfights were rare and gunshots. Stampedes, Indians, and rustlers created the occasional thrill, but gunfights were rare and gunshot wounds usually accidental. Bobby, do you remember the movie The Cowboys with John Wayne?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Wasn't that so good? This just reminds me of that.
I will still sit and watch that several times.
Oh my gosh, me too. I had parts of it memorized when I was younger because I just loved that movie so much. Yeah. I'm glad you saw it too. So what cowboys most often battled were boredom, fatigue, and nature. Dust from trampling hooves coated men as thick as fur, except when heavy rains transformed the trail into a mass of sticky mud. Despite the bandanas that shielded their faces, cowboys could cough up dirty phlegm for weeks after a drive. Hours in the saddle each day caused blisters and back problems, aggravated by nights of sleeping on the ground in the cold and damp. To pass time, cowboys told raunchy jokes, held stag dances, and sang about the miseries of life all on the trail. Some also took out their frustrations on the animals they rode and tended, pushing horses and cattle to the limits of their endurance and punishing them cruelly if they balked. Again, wild, wild west. In 1885, an estimated 7.5 million cattle roamed the prairies north of New Mexico and Texas, with some areas containing four times as many animals as the range could support. Overstocking produced severe overgrazing, which wrecked native grasslands and weakened cattle, but no one cared much about conservation. Disaster struck in 1886 and 1887 when a vicious cycle of summer droughts and bitter winters caused massive losses across the Great Plains. In the northern region, the cattle mortality rate approached 90% and rotting carcasses piled high along the trails and fences. After 1887, cowboys continued to tend vast herds on the public domain, and railroads continued to supply the increasingly mechanized slaughterhouses of Kansas City, St. Louis, and Chicago. From there, Western beef traveled in refrigerated railroad cars to feed the growing populations of industrial cities all over the Midwest and East Coast. As the Great Plains filled with homesteaders, though, large cattle companies grudgingly gave way to family-owned ranches that raised higher quality beef on fewer acres.
We'll be back after this quick break. Are you in the medical field looking for your next opportunity? Listeners, I'm proud to introduce you to Native American veteran-owned staffing company, Worldwide Medical Staffing. Owner and CEO Jackson Weaver is a citizen of the Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma and is a service-connected disabled veteran, where he and his team staff for commercial healthcare and government entities such as the Department of Defense, Department of Energy, and DHS, and specialize in staffing Indian Health and VA hospitals nationwide. Isn't it nice to know that our veterans are being cared for by staff who have been handpicked by a veteran who's been in the staffing business for 17 years? Healthcare job seekers, check out these open jobs on www.medical.com. If you're seeking temporary, long-term, or permanent placement of physicians, advanced practice, registered nurses, and more, check out www.medical.com. And Diako Ki to our medical professionals and to those who have served our country.
Bobby, did you know that cattle rustling, or cattle raiding, as it's more commonly called, it's still a thing going on today? And there are also such things as cattle Ponzi schemes?
Yes, I'm not familiar with the Ponzi schemes, but I do know that occasionally I read stories about cattle rustling, for lack of better word, the cattle theft.
Yeah, and, right. It is, that is what it is.
Right.
Yeah. And you're in Texas. What part of Texas are you in?
The Texas Panhandle.
Okay.
Texas.
I mean, that's what some of what I was reading was some about the Panhandle. It's just shocking to me that that still goes on today.
It is. And the Texas Panhandle is, I'm not sure what beef production here is, but it's probably the largest production area for beef, or raising of beef in the country. So,
all right. So let's go back to Mary Turnbull, who had married Charles Henry Benton. So Charles died in 1888 when the children were actually young. Do you know how he died? I couldn't find anything.
No, there's no record of the cause of death, but he was quite young when he passed away. So,
that's too bad. Mary, I mean,
yeah. And then Mary, I believe, went on to remarry actually three more times.
Oh, did she? Okay.
Uh-huh.
So, but your lineage is from Charles.
Yes.
And Mary was only 32 years old when Charles died. So she had to go look for work, and she took on mail routes as a mail carrier on horseback for the district that most likely included the rough Kaimichi Mountains. However, the job became too dangerous for a woman, and she was forced to abandon it due to robbers, murderers, and cattle rustlers. So Mary had a brother named Turner Turnbull, and he encouraged her to quit her job and move in with him in Mount Pleasant, which was so kind that he took in her and her six children. So it sounds like Mary was really close to her sister, Julia Ann Turnbull Flincham, and they remained close their whole lives. And in 1917, the family story goes that Mary became critically ill while visiting Julia Ann, and either died at Gurdy, where Julia lived, or shortly after she arrived back home. Do you know what she died of?
I do not, but the story goes, we referenced back a time or two, my aunt, who is Irene Coe, was the oldest child and daughter of Toden.
Okay.
And she remembered, and she told the story about riding in a buggy during her funeral. She actually attended Mary's funeral, and so she was the oldest of that group, and is a contributor of many of the stories.
So, do you know anything else about Mary?
Her lineage starts back at John Turnbull, the original Turnbull that. I found this pretty interesting. Moved to the U.S. sometime in the early mid-1700s.
Okay.
And was very, very pro-revolutionary, and lived in Louisiana and traded with the Choctaw Indians, and was a contemporary of... probably George Washington, and named one of his sons George.
Oh, really?
He was Mary's father. So there's some interesting history there as far as the Turnbulls and the original group that moved from Scotland to the U.S.
Yeah, and it's interesting because you would think that Turnbull is actually a Native American name, but it's not.
Right. It sounds very native.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah, and I saw the Turnbull family crest, and I was like, that doesn't look Native American, so it must have been Scottish, right?
Well, they got their name back during the period of Robert the Bruce. The Turnbull name actually came from one of my ancestors, the Turnbull ancestors. A bull was charging Robert the Bruce, and he jumped on the bull and turned his head, saving Robert the Bruce. So that's how the name actually originated back in Scotland in the 1100s, I believe, something of that nature.
How cool is that? Man, you come from some cool people. Yeah, I mean, I've even heard the Turnbull last name over the years and never knew that was not a native name. I just assumed.
Yeah.
Wow. So I was reading about Mary's mother, Jericho, and how she read the Choctaw Bible daily, had family prayer every night, and ruled the large family with strict discipline.
Presbyterian, all of the Benton clan, Turnbull clan, were apparently very religious, Christian families, and not only taught school, but participated in government and and things of that nature. So very concerned about law and order.
Yes. Well, and they seem to be, as you mentioned earlier, very well educated. They believed that that was important for them to be able to be out in the world with the non-natives, it sounded like. So back to Turner Turnbull, there were several Turnbull men over the years, I noticed. So I had to like kind of get my bearings, since there was Turner, Brashears Turnbull Senior, and then Junior, and then like the second, third, and fourth, and so on, or something. I don't know how far down they go, but but I'll start with Mary's father. So Turner Brashears Turnbull Senior, what can you tell us about him?
Well, he attended Choctaw schools, and he called himself a doctor. But again, there was no indication that he had any formal training as a doctor, other than probably had knowledge of herbal medicines and herbal treatments and things like that. Got into politics, and he was known to practice law, and was elected a county judge at one time in the Peshmerga district in 1849. And was eventually chosen as a senator, and later a district governor, which was a chief at that time. So,
and you know, it's interesting because he was born in 1816, so he would have come over during the removal as well.
And I'm not sure if he came from Mississippi or Louisiana.
I have Choctaw, Mississippi, but who knows if that's correct?
Right. Some of the, you know, a lot of the information gets diluted. Yes.
So there's always the disclaimer, I think. You know, as you mentioned, he possibly never truly practiced what we consider medicine, but they say that he had a little black medicine bag that he would carry with him, and then Dr. Turnbull is inscribed on his tombstone. So I think that's awesome.
It is. And probably, you know, you read stories and you hear movies where back then, you know, dentists were often, you know, often practicing medicine and mortuary science and mortuary science and things like that. But So people, I think, found opportunities that, you know, that seemed to work for him. So,
yeah.
So,
oh, totally.
And I think in his latter years, I think political science and politics and things like that were more of his calling, I guess.
Yes. And it's interesting too, that after facing and surviving that removal to Indian Territory, Turner Brashears Turnbull Sr. did really well for himself, becoming a Choctaw Supreme Court judge in 1849, and then a district chief as well, right?
Uh-huh.
That's amazing. So now let's talk about Turner and Jericho's son, Turner Brashears Turnbull Jr. We talked about him a little bit ago that he had suggested that Mary move in with him. Turner Turnbull Jr. was born in 1851 in Blue, Choctaw, Oklahoma. And it was said he was never seen without what?
His Winchester rifle. And this is a colorful person.
Yes.
And I'd like to tell you about his epitaph, you know, and his headstone there at the Turnbull Cemetery. And it reads, through all the pain of times, had a smile of heavenly birth. And when the angels called him home, he smiled farewell to earth. But he was apparently he's defined as a dashing, daring, living by his wits, hard riding, and known to be fast on the trigger, and was never seen without his Winchester rifle. Some of the paper clippings say young children in his presence were said to become unusually quiet and orderly when he was around. And he was very vibrant and just very colorful and exciting. And was one of the original law vigilante Choctaw light horsemen in Indian Territory.
Well, and what I think is amazing, though, too, is like when you just described him, I can totally see that in his photo. He looks like he demands, he just has a demanding presence. Oh, don't you wish we could go back in time and meet him?
love to. I bet he had, I can envision a personality that is just gripping when he walks into a room or something like that.
Yeah. Especially he always had his Winchester with him.
Exactly.
Talk about carrying a big stick.
Right. And the picture that I have with him and his brother, Simon, were on horseback with a group of Choctaw light horsemen. And of course their Winchester rifles and their 1861 Colt revolvers on horseback, ready to ride. So
ready to ride.
Ready
That's
to
amazing.
Ride. And of course, this is the days following the Civil War. Mm-hmm. And Indian Territory was very rough, and outlaws, cattle rustlers, murderers, thieves, just roamed the area.
Right.
And freed slaves migrated to, just south of the Red River into Texas, and would come over the border and just raid Indian homes, villages, towns, steal cattle, horses, and things like that. And Turner Brashears Jr. and his three brothers, Simon and Daniel, were part of the original Turnbull Rangers, which was a vigilante group. And they organized for the protection of the stockmen and were dedicating to ridding the Choctaw and Chickasaw nations of and the Arbuckle and Wichita Hills of all of these marauders, murderers, thieves, and things like that. And
so
they apparently were quite proficient at it. And
let's see, he was Sheriff of Blue County, Indian Territory, and he was head of the Choctaw Light Horsemen from 1890 to 1898. But yet he was also a ranger. So I wonder if one came before the other. Do you happen to know?
I believe so. He was about 21 when he and his brothers, Simon and Daniel, started the Turnbull Rangers, which was more or less a vigilante group, which was probably not quite under the constraints of the law. So
maybe not quite. Okay, gotcha.
Yeah. So, and then
okay, that helps.
Yeah,
because it was like 30 years later, I think, after they had started the Rangers, that he started to as head of the Choctaw Light Horsemen.
Yes.
So they were probably like, we've seen what you've done good work, you need to become a light horseman. For some who may not have heard of them, tell us about the light horsemen.
Basically, the Texas Rangers equivalent for Indian Territory in Oklahoma.
Yeah.
They were the law. They were tasked with rounding up and going after horse thieves, outlaws, murderers, things like that. And kind of along the same storyline is, they would capture some of these people and take them over to, Arkansas. To Fort Smith to Judge Isaac Parker's court and be tried and things like that for the crimes that they committed. In a lot of cases, the outlaws never made it that far.
Right.
There were times that the light horseman would be judge, jury, and executioner. Mm-hmm. And they would catch criminals and pronounce judgment and execution as well. And that eventually got Turner Brashears in trouble with that Judge Parker. There was one incident that I know of where one of their friends was missing some livestock. So Turner, Simon, and Daniel went out, found the thieves, and it was two men, and they basically hung them on the spot. And
wow.
15 of their buddies didn't think that was probably appropriate, so they ended up in a big gun battle with Turner, his brothers, Daniel was actually shot in the lungs and was dying, and he ended his own life with a bullet to the head, stating that his last words were, no horse thief was gonna did not deserve to take his life. So he ended his own life. So they ended up wiping out all 15 of the other outlaws in another gun battle, and which actually got him in trouble with Judge Parker. And Turner Brashears was Judge Parker issued an arrest warrant for him because he didn't quite believe the stories and thought that, the outlaws should have been tried rather than just killed or hung. And so about 15 years, the warrant was out, and Turner evaded that for a number of years, and then
so he finally, was an outlaw.
Oh, he was an outlaw. Yeah, at some point. And he finally turned himself in and was actually tried, and not convicted, and was released. And then he went on to live the rest of his life and raise his family and one night, there was another colorful story that he and his brother Simon had apparently gotten a little bit intoxicated and were racing horses. And Simon, his brother, either the horse fell or he just fell off the horse and it killed him. So, Simon's daughter was noted to have said that, I wish Daddy didn't drink so much, but
that's so sad.
Anyway, they were a pretty wild bunch, pretty colorful, and it sounded like had a good time, actually.
It does, actually.
So
they did what they wanted.
They did what they wanted, and they lived life to its fullest, they thought they were always in the right. They love law and order, and in early Indian territory, law was not always available.
Right.
So they made their own law. So.
Yeah. Well, and as we were talking about the Choctaw Light Horsemen, I was reminded that in season 3, episode 1, I recorded with Ryan Spring and Nick Wallace about the Choctaw Light Horsemen, in case anyone wants to go listen to what they had to say about the Light Horsemen as well. So interesting. So Turner Turnbull also served in the Choctaw House of Representatives, very well respected, and he even married into a well-known family. He married Adeline Dwight, which was daughter of the famous Presbyterian minister Timothy Dwight, and in the 1930s, her brother Ben Dwight was a renowned Choctaw chief. You sent me some information about the Turnbulls from the University of Oklahoma Western Phillips History Collection, which states, "The days following the Civil War were rough in Indian Territory, where outlaws, cattle rustlers, murderers, and horse thieves roamed in abundance. At this point in history, there was little protection from the law for the Indians." So some of this you alluded to earlier. In the early 1870s, when Turner was about 21, he and his brothers, Simon and Daniel, were part of the Turnbull Rangers, a vigilante group organized for the protection of stockmen. They were dedicated to righting the Choctaw and Chickasaw nations in the Wichita and Arbuckle Hills, and along the winding courses of the Washita, Blue, and Red Rivers of outlaws, horse thieves, and murderers. In a Muskogee, Oklahoma letter to the Kansas City Star, it was stated, "They had always lived near Caddo, and the bones of many outlaws and cattle thieves are lying in shallow graves between the Blue and Boggy Rivers, unmarked and unknown, sent to the grave by these brothers and their sworn confederates who, in the days of the Indian courts, generally took the law into their own hands. They hated thieves above all criminals and made short shrift of them when they got a chance with their Winchesters. One time, a bunch of horse thieves had been captured near where the post office of Blue is now located. Three of them, all Choctaw Indians, were killed on the spot. The other, a mere boy, was tied to a tree and whipped into insensibility. He wears the marks of this terrible whipping to this day. He became a minister and is now pastor of a church near Ardmore." So wasn't there a story about how Turner got into a gunfight with a Choctaw lady that was a cattle wrestler or something?
I can't, I don't know that I had the circumstances, but it was in one of these gun battles. And it was a Choctaw woman, and a gunfight ensued, and Turner shot her, whether accidentally or on purpose, I'm not sure, but she was a wife or a girlfriend or a woman of one of the wrestlers.
Okay.
And he was arrested for that as well.
Oh,
and,
boy.
And then tried for the murder of this woman and acquitted, and come to find out that I think she actually pulled a gun on him first. And he drew and killed
him. Yeah. Understandable, though, right? I mean, she shouldn't exactly mess with him, the man that carries a Winchester.
Right.
I mean, it's funny because there's all these dichotomies. Like, on one hand, he was kind of this vigilante, and he was also a light horseman, but he was still in the wild, wild west, you know, still
right,
getting in gunfights and.
Right. Well, you know, you wake up every morning and you know, you hear stories of cattle rustling, murders, and thieves, and
yeah,
and basically his probably character was, I just want law and order. He probably felt like that there was nobody else to do that dirty work, and
mm-hmm,
and maybe, you know, he and his brothers decided that if somebody, you know, it's either us or nobody. And if we
right
don't do it, then it's just going to continue or get worse.
Turner built a large home, which became a refuge for those in the family in need. You mentioned earlier how Simon and Turner were out horseback riding at night, maybe a little too fast. And that was on May 11th, 1881. And that's the night that Simon was killed. The crazy thing too is that Simon's horse was, it ran back to the house and it was struck by lightning while standing in the corral a week later. Mm-hmm.
The original thoughts were that the horse fell with him and that's what killed him. But in all reality, he probably fell off of the horse and the horse just continued to ride. Right. So the horse was uninjured, and right. then ran back to the stall.
But the fact that the horse was okay, but a week later he gets struck by lightning. I mean, again, this is such a Turnbull story, right?
It is. What else could happen? What?
Right. So Turner took in a lot of his family members and children in the family, correct?
Yes. Yes.
Well, sounds like a good man. Such a kind of a patriarch for the family. And that man, who was always known to carry his Winchester rifle everywhere, used the rifle as a crutch in his older years as he had developed a limp from an injury. And how did this vigilante and doer of good end up passing away in 1908?
It was very unexpected, you know, not the way you would expect somebody of his history and stature to pass away in a blaze of glory, blood poisoning from tick bites. So,
gosh, he died from blood poisoning of all things. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't take the man down except from apparently that. So in Muskogee, Oklahoma, a letter to the Kansas City Star read, "Turner Turnbull is dead at his home east of Caddo in the Choctaw Nation, and the man who made his Winchester the law and scattered graves of horse thieves all along the valley of the Blue and Boggy Rivers is what he believed to be a righteous war of extermination, went to his final rest an honored man in his community." One of Turner and his wife's sons was Walter Jonathan Turnbull. What can you tell us about him?
Well, at the age, I believe, of 21, he was elected chief of the Choctaw Nation. But at that time, Woodrow Wilson, the president of the United States, considered him too young and would not recognize him as the chief of the nation. So he was not able to serve, and there was another election. So at one time he was considered the youngest chief of the Choctaw Nation.
Wow. I wonder if he ever tried again later.
I don't think so. Not that I have any kind of historical references to. So
okay. Wow, these Turnbulls were very impressive. And what's crazy is we didn't even scratch the surface of all your family stories and history. You really do come from a long line of Choctaws who did big things in taming the Wild West and did good things for their tribe. Thank you for sharing their stories with us. But before we go, are there any words of wisdom you'd like to share with our listeners?
Well, I would like to say that, you know, a lot of this information, was researched by my uncle, Gene Benton, my mother's brother.
Oh, wonderful.
Another proud Choctaw. And I'd like to give him credit for a lot
Thank
of the
you,
information.
Thank you, Uncle Gene.
Yeah, yeah.
Those people that take the time to do that, it's amazing, and we're grateful for that.
Right, right. So anyway, I would like to thank you for helping me tell the story. It's a lot of fun. It's interesting. And, you know, like you say, we haven't scratched the surface, but it's I don't know that I can live up to the, you know, the colorfulness of it, but certainly we'll give it a try.
Well, let me know if you need bailed out of jail.
I probably will.
Just tell them you're a Turnbull. They'll understand.
That's right. That's exactly right. So.
Well, the Choctaws played a part in taking some of the wild out of the Wild West. They sacrificed and put their lives on the line, in some cases giving their lives to ensure the generations to come could live in a world with less violence and greater harmony. Yakoki to our warriors of every generation, and Yakoki to you, Bobby, for visiting with me today.
Yakoki. Thanks, Rachel. Bye-bye.